This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Michael Caine has been making movies so long that he's probably made more bad films than many actors will appear in over the course of a career. One of the appealing things about Caine's new memoir is that he doesn't mind admitting when a film flops. It's of a piece with the easy charm and Cockney accent that have made Caine a favorite among movie audiences and other actors. Despite the flops, Caine is a great actor. He earned 5 Oscar nominations and won twice for Best Supporting Actor for Hannah and Her Sisters and the Cider House roles. Among his other memorable films are Alfie, Sleuth, The Man Who Would Be King, Educating Rita, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and The Quiet American. In 2000, he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth. Caine was born into a poor neighborhood called Elephant and Castle in South London. He eventually shed his given name, Maurice Micklewhite, and took a stage name from the Caine Mutiny, which starred his idol, Humphrey Bogart. Caine spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies about his new memoir, The Elephant to Hollywood.
Well, Michael Caine, welcome to Fresh Air. As I understand, you started acting in a community theater and kind of stayed with it. And, you know, one of the things that interests me about that is that people who come from working class backgrounds, I think, often have a hard time as young people visualizing themselves escaping that world. What made you think you could?
I don't think I had a choice. If you're in a situation where you have nowhere to go but up, you're going to go up no matter what you do. And I was very fortunate because, you know, we're now talking about the English class system. If you think in terms of class, I was very much lower class, absolutely the wrong kind of accent, a thick Cockney accent. The theatre would have been impossible for me. But I decided to try it anyway, and I was very fortunate because there had never been any leading roles written for working class people in the theatre, with the exception of Liza Doolittle in Pygmalion, and she was there only as a foil for Professor Higgins, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate because writers like John Osborne and Look Back in Anger and all this came on, and so I managed to be able to become a lead, even though I didn't talk what you would call posh. But very funnily for me, my first movie that I ever got attention with a part was a movie called Zulu, where I played an extremely posh officer.
Right.
So it was quite weird that I should do that.
You did a lot of acting in your 20s, but I was surprised to read that you suffered early on from stage fright. How would it manifest itself?
It's not one of the glamorous sides of theatre, but on first nights in the theatre, there's always a bucket by the side in case you want to throw up just before you go on stage, you know? And I used to do that quite regularly. I remember once I was playing a psychiatrist and I read this phrase which stuck in my mind. It said, you become what you are afraid of. I was a very shy child. If anyone came to our house, I would hide behind the curtains. I didn't want to talk or see anybody. And I think I became an actor to overcome that fear. I became what I was afraid of, in other words.
How did you overcome the stage fright, or do you still get it?
I became a Stanislavski actor, and he has a line that he says of advice or learning. He says, the rehearsal is the work, the performance is the relaxation. So by the time that I've got, like I'm a movie actor now, by the time I've got to a scene in the studio, I have rehearsed it over and over so many times that it's just second nature to me. So you have to bring about this relaxation in a movie because the camera is so close and so sharp and it will pick up any signs of fear. And I also have a definition of movie acting is that it's really being a character. For instance, if you're watching me give a performance and you turn to your companion, you say, isn't that Michael Caine a wonderful actor? Then I've failed. You're supposed to say, I wonder what's going to happen to Harry Brown now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You've got to make yourself disappear. In theatre, which is the opposite, you really make the acting work for you. In movies, you dump the acting and become.
Well, let's talk about Alfie, which was a real breakout picture for you. I mean, it really made you an international star. Got you a Best Actor nomination for the Oscars. And I thought we would listen to a scene. This is early in the film. You play Alfie, who is, of course, a young man who gads about having affairs with all kinds of women. And this is early in the film where you've just had a liaison with a married woman. She's in her car about to depart. And you turn and talk to the camera, although first we hear her say farewell. So let's listen.
I've had a lovely time, Alfie.
A married woman, see? They're every one of them in need of a good laugh. You don't never strike their husbands. I always say, make a married woman laugh and you're halfway there with her. Of course, it don't work with a single bird. Start you off on the wrong foot. You get one of them laughing, you won't get nothing else. Here, just listen to it. It was dead glum when I met it tonight. I listened to all its problems, then I got it laughing. It'll go home happy.
And that's my guest, Michael Caine.
Made me laugh.
It's still fun to hear?
I'm sitting here laughing, yeah. I'd forgotten that line. But there, by the way, is an example of a very much thicker Cockney accent than the one I have today, because what happened on Alfie is I made Alfie where I played this Cockney. And then after the picture had been out and been a success in England, the director called me and said, you've got to re-loop, which means re-record, 120 lines in the picture. And I said, what for? He said, it's going to America, and the Americans don't understand what you're talking about. So I had to do a load of redubbing on that.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about the clip that we just heard is that kind of halfway through Alfie's little narrative, he begins referring to the woman he's just, had this affair with as it.
Yeah.
Which kind of reminds us that this is not exactly a charming rogue who means no harm. He really treats these women very badly.
Oh, yeah. And the thing about him was that he was an innocent. And in the last line he says in the picture is, what's it all about? He doesn't understand. He doesn't understand why everybody's against him, what's going on, you know? And there were many men. One of my best friends was like that. He got all the girls, you know, but he was very male chauvinistic, you know, to refer to a woman as it.
Well, you know, there was a time in the 60s here. This film was made in 66, and your career really took off, and you were single then, and, you know, young, single, having a grand time, plenty of, I assume, casual relationships with women. And I wonder, did people think of you as Alfie? Did you feel like you had to be Alfie?
No. People said, you really like Alfie? I said, no. They said, but wait a minute, you were going around with different girls just like Alfie, and you were very similar. I know, I said this. I was a man who very much respected his mother. I remember once my wife, Shakira, my wife of 40 years, she was doing an interview and I was in the other room. The reporter said to her, I was listening, sort of half listening, to see what she said anything about me. And he said, what first attracted you to Michael? And there was a pause, and she said, the way he treated his mother. And that was me. I have tremendous respect for women. And so, Alfie was a man who would have sex anywhere, anytime, with anybody. That was not me at all. Never in a million years. I was a romantic, put it that way.
One of the lovely details in this book is when you had your early successes with the film Zulu and the Ypres File and then Alfie, that at the premieres for your date, you invited your mom.
One of them I invited my mother. The first one was Zulu. And I invited my mother. There was a very big premiere in the West End, which is like Broadway in America. And I asked my mother to go to the premiere with me, and she wouldn't go. So I went with a very beautiful girl, whose name escapes me now. And going in with all the flashlights and posing with the beautiful girl, and the crowds were being held back by the police, and it was sort of a bit mayhem, you know? It was a big premiere. And in the middle of the crowd being pushed and shoved around, I saw my mother. And for a minute, I was so angry, you know. But after we got out of the theater at the end, I telephoned and she was home. And I said, what were you doing there? I asked you to come. She said, I thought it wouldn't be good for your career to turn up with your mother, she said. she said, you know, I wanted you to be with a lovely girl, you know, and everything would look good. She said, but I also wanted to be there and see how it was. So that's why I went. But then the next time, Ipcrestvale, I made her come to the premiere and I bought a mink coat for her to go in.
You grew up in South London from humble origins, kind of worked your way up. What was it like when you first went to Hollywood?
It was quite weird because I went there and I was going to do a picture with Shirley MacLaine and she wasn't there. She was working on another picture and she was just finishing up. Until we officially had the party welcoming me to Hollywood, I didn't know this. I was in this very luxurious suite in the Beverly Hills Hotel and no one talked to me and no one came. They just paid the bills and that was it, you know. And so I used to sit in the lobby looking for movie stars, which is where I met John Wayne for the first time. And we became friends, not close friends. I mean, we hardly moved in the same circles, but we became very deep acquaintances, put it that way. And he was very kind to me, gave me all sorts of advice, like talk low, talk slow, and don't say too much. Don't wear suede shoes. I said, why not wear suede shoes? He said, because you'll be in the toilet taking a pee and a guy will recognize you and he'll turn to you and say, Michael Caine. And he will have peed all over your shoes, Michael. But so I said, all right, I won't wear suede shoes.
This is not the advice John, you got when you first came to Hollywood.
That was my first advice from John Wayne, yeah.
Well, I wanted to talk about another film that got you a Best Actor nomination, Sleuth, 1972. Where you appear with Laurence Olivier, and it's based on a play by Anthony Schaefer. This very intense drama. I think it's just the two of you in every single scene.
Yes, it was.
He plays a wealthy guy. You're a younger man who's having an affair with his wife, and he's invited you to his home for a talk. So let's listen to a scene.
Well, I understand you want to marry my wife. Forgive me raising the matter, but as Marguerite is away for a few days in the north visiting relatives, I thought this might be an appropriate moment for you and me to have a little chat.
I see.
Well, is it true?
Yes.
With your permission, of course.
Why not? You seem to be a personable enough young man, nicely spoken, neatly dressed in brand new country gentleman's clothing. I'm sure you won't mind me asking you a few questions about your background. Parents and so forth.
My mother was born in Hereford, mm-hmm. a farmer's daughter, mm-hmm. and my father is an Italian who came to this country in the 30s from Genoa.
In the 30s? Jewish?
No, Catholic. Very devout. Of course, I'm not religious at all myself.
My dear boy, you don't have to excuse yourself to me. We're all liberals here. I have no prejudice against Catholics, not even lapsed Catholics. In fact, some of my best friends are lapsed Catholics. But tell me about your father. Was his name Tyndall, too?
No, his name was Tyndallini. Mm. But if you had a name like that in those days, you had to make it an ice cream. He was a watchmaker, and he wanted us to become English, so he changed it.
Become English? Was he a successful man?
No. As a matter of fact, he wasn't. You can't expect to make a living these days, just repairing watches. Mm. He went broke in the end. I always told him he would.
And that's our guest, Michael Caine, in the 1972 film Sleuth with Laurence Olivier. Interesting there. Olivier is such an upper-class snoot, and you're of more humble origins. Was it intimidating for you as an actor at that age to work with Laurence Olivier?
Oh, yeah. He was the greatest actor in the world, stage, screen, everything. You know, he was incredible. I was just listening to there, and that was a supreme example of a class, the way he was talking about Catholics and lapsed Catholics. Some of my best friends are lapsed Catholics, you know, and that sort of thing. Because in actual fact, in real life, Larry was a lord. And before we started the film, I'd never met him. And we had to start rehearsals. And he wrote me a little letter, very nice letter, saying, it has occurred to me that you may be, as I am a lord, you may be wondering how to address me when we meet. And he said, and then there was a new paragraph, and he said, when we do meet, Michael, from the moment we shake hands, I will be Larry forevermore. Which was lovely, you know. He put me out of any sort of worries socially. But the idea that he had to do it is extraordinary and very difficult to explain. It explains a very difficult thing in the class system in England. Because if you cut to later, I did a remake of Sleuth playing
right.
Larry's part.
The older character,
the older man, and Jude Law played the young seducer. And I was thinking about that because I am now a knight. You know, I'm Sir Michael Caine. But the idea that I would write a letter to Jude saying, you may be wondering how to address me when we first meet. Once we meet, you may call me Michael forevermore. It showed how the class system changed over the 20 years between those two movies.
One of the interesting turns in your story is in 1991 when you learned that there was a half-brother that you'd never known about or known. Your parents were both dead at this point. How did you find out?
My half-brother was in a mental institution. He was 8 years older than me. Obviously my mother knew, but nobody in my family had any inkling of this man. His name was David. But the most extraordinary thing that we found out when I found out about it, and I'll tell you first how I found out. A newspaper in England was doing an article, a series, on the state of mental health treatment in England. And the reporter eventually rang me and told me that I had my half-brother because I never knew and my mother and father were dead. And the way he found out, he was in a hospital doing his thing, you know, his program about the state of mental health. And this girl, who was also a mental patient, came over and pointed at David and said, that is Michael Caine's brother. And, of course, this reporter went, what? And he investigated it, and lo and behold, it was my half-brother. And he rang me and said, and he was very nice. They didn't make a big deal out of it, you know, sensationalism. He said, but he is your half-brother. He said, and the way we found out is that there is a picture of you with your mother just on the wall by his bed. And that's the woman who comes and visits him. And then I talked to the matron, and then she's told me the full story. So I had this half-brother there, but the most extraordinary thing about it was that for 51, 2 or 3 years, my mother had visited him every Monday without fail, except for the 5 years of the war when everyone was evacuated.
Now, just to be clear, this was an illegitimate child that your mom had had?
Illegitimate child that she'd had 8 years before she had me when she wasn't married to my father was in the Indian Army. He was in the Royal Horse Artillery in India. And so he was away and she'd had this illegitimate child. And what you did with them because of the shame is you gave it to the Salvation Army. And he had epilepsy and they'd obviously left him in a room with a very hard floor and no attention, and he'd battered himself into incoherence. When I finally met him, he spoke, but I couldn't understand what he said. And the only person who could understand was the matron who had been with him the longest, and she translated. She was like an interpreter for me when we talked to each other. Mm. And I obviously looked after him very well for the next 2 years when he died. Years ago.
Yeah, it's remarkable that your mom made these visits and kept
secret. That's what's incredible.
Took him sweets and the like.
Yeah, I mean, my mother used to come to me on the weekend, you know, and on Monday when she went back, you know, I'd give her all the rest of the box of chocolates, boxes of biscuits, you know, cookies, as you call them in America, and, you know, 3/4 of a cake, which we hadn't eaten. And for her, you know, and I had other family living in the house where she lived. And I would go up there and see her on a Wednesday and have a cup of tea, which was only 2 days later. And I'd say, I'd like a biscuit. And she'd say, I haven't got one. Of course, she'd been taking them to David. And I found out I had a Rolls Royce and a chauffeur to full. And my chauffeur, he said one day, he said, you do know, he said, whenever I take your mum home on a Monday, I never take her to the house. I said, where do you drop her off? He said, I drop her off at a bus stop. And I said, what did she say she's going to do? He said, she's going shopping. what she was absolutely going to do was take the food and the chocolates to David in the mental home.
I wanted to talk a little bit about The Man Who Would Be King, which you start in with Sean Connery, directed by John Huston. Quite a tale of, you know, the Rudyard Kipling story. How did you get that part?
I was sleeping late in bed with my wife in the George V Hotel in Paris on a Saturday morning. It was about 11 o'clock. We'd been out very late at probably Regine's Disco in Paris. My wife and I used to go to Paris for weekends for honeymoon. Well, we still do, as a matter of fact. And the phone went in the bedroom, and I sort of picked it up very flustered. I was half asleep. I said, yes. He said, this is John Huston. I'd like to have a chat with you about making a movie. And I said, now, come on, who is this? Because all my mates would do jokes on me like that, you know. So he said, no, it's John Huston. And I said, no, come on. And he said, Michael, it's John Huston, and I want you to do a movie with me. And he told me the story of The Man Who Would Be King. And he said it was going to be played by Humphrey Bogart, who was my favorite actor of all time. And he said, I'd like to see you to talk about it. So I said, yeah. I said, anytime, anytime. He said, well, I'm in the bar next door. He said, can you come down? So I said, yeah. I jumped out of bed, come here, dashed out and went down and had my first chat with him and that got the part. And I had an incredible experience because John was the greatest director, I think. I've worked with some great directors, but he was one of the greatest directors I ever worked with.
And what was distinctive about his approach?
He never said anything. I said to him one day, I said, John, you never give me any directions. He said, the art of direction, Michael, is casting. If you've cast it right, you don't have to say anything. Anyway, he said, why do I have to tell you a lot of stuff? He said, you get paid a great deal of money to do this. You should know how to do it without me telling you.
Well, you know, we should listen to just a clip of this, of A Man Who Would Be King. And for those that don't know, it's the Rudyard Kipling story of these two sergeants in the English army in India who finish their service and then sort of become these rogue scammers and then have this idea that they will have this plot to become a king of Kafiristan. And here, this scene is fairly late in the film where, in fact, you have made it to Kafiristan. Sean Connery is regarded by the locals as a god. Your character, Peachy, is trying to convince him that it's time to get the loot and get out of there. He is so enraptured with his role as, you know, as a deity that he wants to stay. So let's listen.
Danny, we've had this rare streak of luck. Let's quit winners for once. Cut and run while the running's good.
You call it luck. I call it destiny.
Ha ha! Pardon me while I fall down laughing. Whatever you may think, and however you may feel, I'm a king and you're a subject. So don't you provoke me, Peachy Cutter. Or you'll do what? You got me trembling in my boots here. What'll you do?
You have our permission to bugger off.
That I'll do. With or without your bleeding permission. And may you rot in hell, Daniel Dravot.
That's our guest, Michael Caine, with Sean Connery in The Man Who Would Be King. Do you remember shooting that scene?
Oh, yeah, very well. And we shot all that in Morocco, but very funny enough, we're going to be kings of Kafiristan, I remember saying. And yesterday I saw Kafiristan on the television, and it's a major Taliban stronghold right now.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
There are so many movies of yours we could talk about, but I wanted to talk about The Cider House Rules, which you made in 2000, won you your second Oscar. It's a lovely film, really, based on a John Irving novel, and I thought we'd listen to a bit of this. You play a doctor at an orphanage for unwanted children in Maine who also performs abortions for young women who need them. There's a young man there, played by Tobey Maguire, named Homer, who you've trained as a gynecologist and has learned to deliver babies, but he refuses to do abortions. It's against his principles. And in this particular scene we're going to hear, a young teenage girl has come in distress because she has been to a back alley abortionist, and you're treating her. You speak first to her and then to this young apprentice, Homer.
Dear child, did you do something to yourself?
It wasn't me.
Did you go to someone else?
He said he was a doctor. I would have never stuck that inside me.
Listen.
It wasn't me.
Listen, you've been very brave. They're not going to put you to sleep.
It wasn't me.
Homer, I want you to see this. You won't feel it anymore. You've been very brave. We'll make it deep.
You sure?
You bet. Fetus is unexpelled. The uterus is punctured. She has acute peritonitis. There is a foreign object. I think it's a crochet hook. Take this. If she had come to you 4 months ago and asked for a simple D&C, what would you have done? Nothing. This is what doing nothing gets you. It means that somebody else is going to do the job. Some moron who doesn't know how.
And that's our guest Michael Caine with Tobey Maguire in his Oscar-winning performance in The Cider House Rules. The relationship between you and Tobey Maguire, it's kind of a father-son relationship, and it's really touching. He wants to go out and see the world. You want him to remain at the orphanage and continue to serve the young women and the kids who are there.
Yeah, well, he was an orphan too, you see.
Right.
And so I had brought him up in that way, you know. People say to me, you worry about acting with children. I said, watch your Cider House Rules. I have 150.
Right, you're reading stories to kids, and you have that wonderful line where you say goodnight. What is the
good
line?
Goodnight, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England.
Right, right.
Yeah. That's what people come up to me, American men come up to me in the street, and they say to me, you know what I say to my boys before they go to bed? I say, it's not goodnight, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England, is it? You say, oh, yeah, you guessed.
Our guest is Michael Caine. His new memoir is called The Elephant to Hollywood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is actor Michael Caine. He's written a new memoir called The Elephant to Hollywood. You know, you've been in the business so long, made, what, over 100 films, I guess, right?
Yeah, I've been in 100, yeah.
And, you know, anybody who's had a long career is going to have some stinkers in the mix. And one of the things I like about your book is that you fully acknowledge that there are things that didn't work.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite moment from any of those that didn't work that you just love to look back on and laugh about?
No, any of those films that didn't work, I never ever saw. I know the scene that I love. I did a very bad movie called The Swarm.
Mm-hmm.
The Swarm was about bees, very malignant bees attacking in hordes, attacking people and killing them.
Henry Fonda was in that, wasn't he?
Henry Fonda, one of my favorite actors. Uh-huh. Dick Widmark. I was working with all my good guys. But there is a moment in there with all the bees, and we had to do a scene where we were smothered in bees, you know? We were doctors. It was Hank Fonda and me. We were wearing white smocks, sort of doctor's coats, and they let all these bees go out of these hives, thousands of them. And they came in, and we suddenly noticed that our white smocks sort of starting to get a very, very pale brown mist. Very, very pale. But and what we didn't realize was that bees, when caged, do not defecate in their habitation, shall we say. They wait till the moment they're released and sort of busting themselves. And they released like 500,000 bees and they all crapped all over us. which sort of anticipated the critics by about 9 months. That's the funniest scene in one of those, because I did see The Swarm. And you can actually see, if you're looking, the brown film on our tunics.
You know, I have to ask you before we go. I spoke to a friend in the last couple of days and said I was going to be interviewing Michael Caine. And she said, oh, he's so great. He's such a great actor, and he's such a wonderful guy. And, of course, she's never spent a minute in your presence. But I think there is this image of you, maybe because of your Cockney accent or because of the roles you've had, that people just figure that you're a guy they could share a beer with and they'd love to hang with. Is it a burden to have that image? Is that you?
It's exactly me. Yeah, I'm very much socially, and I hasten to add, only socially, I'm a communist. Everybody is exactly the same to me. I treat everybody exactly the same until they answer. then I figure out who they are.
Is it ever tiresome? I mean, people expect you to never have an impatient moment, you know?
Yeah, but I never do. I control my temper. I have a terrible temper, and I've learned early on to control it. I remember I lost my temper very badly on a picture called The Last Valley when they put me on a horse that hadn't been trained properly, and I'm a terrible rider, and they'd assured me that it was very quiet. And then it threw me off, and I hurt myself, and I really had a go at the crew, and they were all laughing at me, you know? And I really, really lost my temper. And James Clavell, was the director, and he said, OK, half an hour's break, everybody. Let's go and have a cup of tea, Michael, in my motorhome. So we went to his motorhome. And he said, I was captured by the Japanese in Hong Kong when I was 14. I said, I know you were, Jim. He said, and I survived that by watching and learning from them. He said, and the thing I learned that I could tell you today is never to lose your temper. He said, because anger is a very, very important emotion, and you must never, ever share important emotions with strangers, because you will only lose face, because none of it is important to them. And I never, ever lost my temper on a movie set ever again.
Well, Michael Caine, it's been fun. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
Michael Caine spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Caine's new memoir is called The Elephant to Hollywood. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Dinao Mengistu's new novel, How to Read the Air. Mengistu is named one of the 20 writers under 40 to watch by The New Yorker magazine, where some of his fiction has been published. His first novel, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, received the Los Angeles Times First Book Award and was named a New York Times notable book. Maureen says Mengistu's winning streak is still going strong.
In his 1988 memoir called simply A Life, the controversial director Elia Kazan told a World War II story I've always wanted to believe is true. Kazan wrote that he was present in 1945 on the Pacific island of Biak when his newly released film, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, was shown to a battle-scarred audience of American soldiers and nurses. The movie was projected on an outdoor screen in the rain at night, and the audience was rapt despite planes circling overhead and the other noises of war. In the middle of the movie, the film reel broke, and Kazan recalled that a great groan of disappointment erupted from the audience before the film was fixed and the show continued. The next morning, rumor went around the base that some Japanese soldiers still at large on the island had climbed to the top of a nearby hill and also had watched the movie. I guess they groaned too when the film broke. After all, everybody loves a good tearjerker about immigrants and promises just out of reach. Of course, they don't make them like that anymore. The stories and memoirs written by newer waves of immigrants to America, writers like Julia Alvarez, Juno Diaz, and Gish Jen, commute back and forth between the old world and the new, while the immigrant community, unlike Kazan's lively Brooklyn streets, is much less sentimentalized and more fragmented and mobile. Add to this canon of ambivalent new chroniclers of the dream of America, Dinau Mengistu, who was born in Ethiopia, emigrated to the United States as a child, and educated at Georgetown University, where somehow he managed to avoid taking any of my courses. I don't know him, but I do know some of his work. Mengistu has just published his second novel, How to Read the Air, and it's a sad stunner of a meditation on the illusory idea of asylum. Mengistu's main character, Jonas Wuldemariam, is not even at home in his own skin, let alone in his adopted home of New York City. A first-generation American, Jonas grew up in the Midwest, the only child of Ethiopian refugees who barely spoke to each other during the decades of their troubled marriage. Jonas says about his family that what we were was something closer to a jazz trio than a family, a performance group that got together every now and then to play a few familiar notes before dispersing back to their real private lives. Jonas has earned a Hard Knocks advanced degree in alienation. He works first at an immigrant aid society. Later, he gets a job teaching composition at a snooty prep school in Manhattan. The hasty marriage that Jonas has embarked on with a lawyer at the AIDS Society is falling apart. As it does, Jonas keeps thinking back on his family legacy of rootlessness. His parents transplanted lives in Peoria, Illinois, and before that, his father's rough exodus from Ethiopia to Europe, sealed in a box smuggled aboard a cargo ship. The narrative jumps around restlessly among all these time frames, but the description Jonas relates secondhand of his father's odyssey is especially evocative. In Italy, my father was given asylum and set free. He met dozens of men along the way, men who promised him that when they made it to London, the rest of their lives would finally resolve into the picture they imagined. "It's different there," they always said. For most, that place of difference was London. For a few, it was Paris. And for a smaller but bolder few, America. That faith had carried them thus far, and even though it was weakening and needed constant readjustment, "Rome is not what I thought it would be. France will surely be better," it persisted out of sheer necessity. By the time my father finally made it to London, he had begun to think of all the men he met as being crippled and deformed by their dreams. At the three hanky end of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, Francie Nolan and her kid brother look out from their tenement rooftop to the skyline of Manhattan. They're certain that a bright American future is theirs, just over the bridge. In Dinau Mengistu's beautifully written and wearier update of the Coming to America story, refugees and their offspring cross a lot of bridges, but none of them ever find the clean, well-lighted place of their dreams. It seems that the wanderers in this novel are destined to be a country unto themselves.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed How to Read the Air by Dinau Mengistu. In 1968, the Beatles became the second huge-selling act to own their own record label, the first being Frank Sinatra and Reprise Records. Apple Records not only released the Beatles' own singles and albums, but also music by other performers the individual Beatles liked. A new box set of 17 CDs includes 16 remastered albums and a CD of singles. Our rock historian Ed Ward recently reviewed the singles compilation called Come and Get It. Today, he reviews the albums.
Apple Records was intended to be a label like no other. For one thing, it had the Beatles, but it also had, behind the scenes, Derek Taylor and Peter Asher, two of the smartest and hippest men in the record business at the time. And in the beginning, the world was anxious to see what it would do. The first thing it did was to throw a curveball.
Little pebble upon the sand, now you're lying here in my hand. many years have you been here? Little human upon the sand, from where I'm lying here in your hand, you to me are but a passing breeze. The sun will always shine where you stand, depending in which land you may find yourself. Now you have my blessing, go your way. La 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 la.
The English have a word, twee, which is hard to define, but once you've been exposed to it, you know it when you hear it. Mary Hopkin, a Welsh singer who entranced Paul McCartney from her televised appearance on a talent search show, became Apple's first release with a single, Those Were the Days, which hasn't improved with age, and an album, Postcard, which includes The Puppy Song, as well as Donovan's Happiness Runs and There's No Business Like Show Business. Fortunately, Paul redeemed himself shortly thereafter. Peter Asher had been half of Peter and Gordon, and the drummer of a band which had backed them on their American tours also played in a band called The Flying Machine, which had just broken up. Their lead singer and chief songwriter left for London with Asher's phone number in his pocket, unaware of Asher's new job. He sent in a tape, Asher played it for McCartney, and before James Taylor's jet lag wore off, he had an Apple contract.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? And ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Karen, she's a silver sun. You gotta walk her away and watch her shine. Watch her watch the morning come. A silver tear appearing now, I'm crying. Ain't I gone to Carolina in my mind? Ain't no doubt.
This version of Carolina in My Mind is from the demo tape Taylor sent Asher, and it's easy to see why he got excited. The orchestrated versions of the songs on the finished album were very much of their times, and Taylor might have become a star had his heroin habit not put him in rehab while the tour was being organized. As it was, he'd have to wait until Asher landed at Warner Brothers in 1970 before his career took off. McCartney's other find was the Ivies, more Welsh people, who were rechristened Badfinger and inserted into the soundtrack of the film The Magic Christian, in which Ringo played a hunchback dwarf.
No matter what you are,
end up having four top 20 hits on Apple, all very Beatlesque pop, although the four Apple albums show them to have been very versatile and still stand up well today. Paul McCartney wasn't the only Beatles signing acts to Apple. The Undertakers were a big deal on the Merseybeat scene the Beatles had emerged from, and their gimmicky appearance didn't hide the fact that guitarist Jackie Lomax was a guitarist and songwriter of some talent, and George Harrison saw to it that he wound up on Apple for an album. Despite the presence of George, Paul, Ringo, Eric Clapton, and Keith Richards on the album, it and the single released from it stiffed. Harrison also used his awakening religious interests to sign the Radhakrishna Temple of London, as well as gospel prodigy Billy Preston and soul singer Doris Troy to the label. Even Ringo got into the act with a signing you'd never expect. His brother introduced him to the music of composer John Taverner, whose 1966 oratorio, The Whale, about the biblical Jonah, and his Celtic Requiem both came out on Apple, although these pieces are very dated now, and Taverner has matured into Britain's best-loved composer. And the modern jazz quartet? That was Peter Asher. He heard the venerable jazz combo was out of a contract, so they got to make two excellent albums for Apple, which were reissued on one disc here. Apple only lasted until 1973, and although it had limited success with its releases, most of them are worth revisiting today to see what you missed.
Ed Ward lives in France. He reviewed the Apple Records box set. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.